Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to episode 154 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. This episode is the second of our recordings taken from the Here Comes the Weekend Paul Weller celebration in Woking in the summer of 2023. Enjoy.
On this episode, I am joined by a multi-instrumentalist, a producer, a songwriter, who just happens to be one of the founders of influential 80s Brit soul flag bearers, Loose Ends. I'm told, and you'll see this when he comes on stage, that he was a model at one point as well. We may get into that. And most importantly, for the purposes of this conversation, he just happens to have played trumpet, trombone, and keys with the best band in the fucking world, The Jam! Please welcome the legend that is Steve Nicol. I love it. Hey, look, and now I don't feel left out with the, or out of place rather, with the Nike. We've got the whole Air Jordan and the Nikes going on. We're not just Adidas in the room. Steve, thank you so much for joining me. I mean, you don't talk about this kind of thing really to anybody. So this is a real honor, real pleasure.
Thank you. No, I don't really actually. This is like probably the first podcast I'm actually talking about Paul and The Jam.
So this is going to be special. All right. This is for you in the room here today. Obviously, if there's a load of stuff where he's slagging Weller off, I'm going to cut that out, right?
No. I've got to
bear in mind the end game.
That's not going to happen.
Let's kick off right at the early days, right? So I read as a kid, and I've got a couple of kids who are just starting to get into learning the piano, maybe like 5 minutes a day. But you would practice 2 hours a day on the piano and 3 hours a day on the trumpet, Monday to Friday. Was that right?
How did you find that out? Yeah, that's true. That's exactly what happened. The minute the piano came in from... The church was actually getting remodeled down the road. So the priest said to my mother, would you like a piano? So the piano was actually shifted over to our house, and it spent about a year in the hallway, and then it got shifted to my bedroom, and the rest is history after that.
How big was this thing?
The piano. Yeah. It was an upright grand.
What a gift. My God.
Yeah. Fantastic gift. And it was all in tune as well.
Nice. Okay. And you were classically trained from the age of 11?
Yeah, from the age of 11, classically trained at secondary school. So I'm actually quite a late starter when it comes to learning an instrument, because nowadays they learn instruments in primary schools. But I was quite a late starter, but I quickly developed. So by the time I was 13, I'd done quite a lot of stuff.
And what music were you digging? What was the thing? What were the things that you were listening to?
I was like an all-rounder, everything. I mean, in those days, I wasn't listening to a lot of reggae, in fact, because they used to call me like a posh boy at school. So I was listening to a lot of pop songs, really.
Now, the Jam story, in terms of your approach, kicks in with a chap called Keith Thomas. And I want to talk about Keith, because Keith sadly passed away last year.
Yeah, sadly he passed away last year. Yeah.
And it was down to him that you joined the lineup. But tell me about your relationship pre The Jam. How did you know Keith?
I went down on a bus down into Peckham to the post office one morning, and I was picking up a gyro check. Keith Thomas knew me, and we got talking, basically. And to cut a long story short, he said to me, there's an audition going for The Jam. Now, my friend who I play with cannot make it, so do you mind coming along? So, and that's how it happened.
And this is Frankie B.
Yeah, Frankie B.
Frank Burke. By name, not by nature.
Yeah, but was playing trumpet.
Missed out on joining the jam then.
Yeah, he missed out on joining the jam. Yeah, from Second Image. Yeah.
Oh, I bet he was gutted.
He was after he saw what was going on.
Pre that, how did you know Keith? Where had you met?
I knew Keith from playing the saxophone. I used to see him walking around with his saxophone all the time in Peckham. And I knew his brother, Roger, that actually played the saxophone as well. So that's how I really got together with him.
And that's a good instrument to choose if you think about it, right? You can carry it around on your shoulder. You can wander about with it. The piano, less so.
No, the trumpet, definitely.
Yeah, you picked the right one there. But did you have a favorite between the two?
Well, you know what? Trumpet was my first instrument. So trumpet was the first instrument I started at 11. And about 11 and a half, I started the piano.
And gigging with a trumpet is... you look up sometimes, don't you, and think these things are easy. But that's a real athletic thing to be playing that for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours of a gig, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was doing a lot of sports as well at school, so that really did help a lot. Played a lot of football, so that did help.
But it's like you've got to think about lung capacity. You've got to think about keeping your lips in good condition. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, right?
But yeah, the embouchure is really the most important thing on the trumpet. And I was lucky enough to be able to play with no pressure. But most trumpeters use a lot of pressure. I was able to like develop a technique where I had less pressure on my my lips. So I actually got a better sound out of the instrument.
And how is that just practice?
Yeah, that's just practice. Yeah. So the amount of hours I was doing a day. I mean, I was driving the neighbors mad to start with, obviously. And then after I started to get a tune together, things started to change.
I love that the idea that the next door neighbors hear this evolution, this journey of just this absolute din coming from next door. And it's like, what the hell is that? And then over time, it's like, this is beautiful. I'm going to get the deck chair in the garden, listen to this guy. How long did it take for you to get any good at it?
About 6 months before I did my first exam. That was quite good. And then about the same on the piano. So they were following sort of hand in hand. So about 6 months apart.
Did you ever do that kind of show-offy thing where you've got... I've seen Paul play the piano and he's had the guitar in his lap. Have you seen that as well? And he's kind of like...
No, I couldn't.
Could you do that with a trumpet?
No, you can't do it with a trumpet because you need to use both hands. Well, so yeah, that would have been quite tricky.
Now, so we mentioned this poor old Frankie B who couldn't make the gig. So you go down to Gnomis.
Yeah, down to Gnomis Studios. Yeah. And waltzed in there. And the first person that I bumped into was Tony Hadley. Yes. Yeah, they were actually in the next studio rehearsing. That lot looked like a bunch of models. They were just standing there posing away. And I sort of introduced myself and then went round to the back where we were.
And talk me through that. I mean, this is not X Factor type thing. It's not Red Buzzer, but talk me through that process.
It was really, really strange because what I could recollect is that Paul would actually just play some riffs on the guitar. And he said, look, what I'm going to do... I'm going to play down a couple of songs and then you can tell me which ones you like, which ones you think might need brass and which ones won't need brass. So that's how it went.
The band at this point are huge.
Yeah.
But it's still a really collaborative process. He's not directing you.
He was really open about the whole situation. He says, I said to him basically, what style would you like? Obviously not jazzy, but he said to me, no, whatever you think you would fit the material that they're doing. So between Keith and myself, we sat down and came up with these like sort of funky type arrangements.
Were the Jam a band that you'd been into? Had you seen them live?
Yeah, I'd definitely seen Paul, yeah. And definitely seen the Jam like on TV and stuff. It was like a band that you'd like look up to because they're around the same time as The Clash and all that.
So you always see these kind of, you know, the three of them on stage, you know, Paul, Bruce and Rick, this incredible sound that comes from them. And they've talked about, I think it was Rick talking about the fact they always played as if they felt they were a four piece. That's how they started.
Yeah, they sounded like a four piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you always watching it going, do you know what? What they're missing is a bit of brass on this.
No, I didn't actually. I thought it might heighten the situation. It did add a greater depth to the music, definitely.
So the thing that you get brought into, and actually, I think that day you start recording, don't you?
Yeah, I actually started recording that day when I actually was in the studio doing that audition.
It's, which I just find remarkable because it seems like even with the Style Council we were talking about yesterday and with Paul Weller solo, it's like The audition process isn't long and tiring. There's not like a queue of people. It's not like the acting world. There's a queue of people in a green room kind of waiting for their audition, and then he picks somebody. It's like actually the people going into the room have been selected, and then you're getting the gig, and then you're recording out songs for the gift.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because I came from a classical background, it was a little bit easier for me because I'm used to be playing in a symphony orchestra, playing with a brass section that is so particular. There is sort of no emotion, really. Everything is really, really intense with regards to the symphony orchestra. But at the same time, it's a different style of music. But then coming into the intensity of the jam, there's only one way you can go. You can go hard and go strong, basically.
You need to be match fit for those.
Yeah, you've got
well,
to
right?
be. You've got
yeah.
to be.
And at the Guildhall, presumably they're talking you, teaching you how to read music and how to perform and stuff. But how much of that learning was about kind of freestyle and
well, things? Actually, at school, they taught you to read and write music, basically. So, and I used to go to the CYM, College for Young Musicians, at 13. And then by 16, I was playing in the symphony orchestra, London School Symphony Orchestra. By 18, I was principal trumpet, and I'd already toured halfway around the world doing that. So that sort of level, I was actually quite used to. So, but on the other side, but then coming around with Paul now and going into the studio, it was quite exhilarating to have to do like brass arrangements, like on the spot, which literally it was. You had to be really, you had to have your wits about you, and you had to think on a slightly different level. It's almost like improvisation, like you're trying to say. It was more like improvisation because of riffs. You do a riff and then you think, oh, what was that riff again? Can I remember it? And that's exactly what went on.
And it's you and Keith working with Paul. Were Bruce and Rick there?
Yeah, and Bruce and Rick were definitely there. Paul was saying, yeah, I like this and I don't like that, basically. Okay. He was the main person behind everything.
So there was an interview with Paul in The Guardian in, when was it, 2012. And he said, we'd already moved on from punk very quickly. And he talks about the fifth album. So by the fifth album, Sound Effects, there were a lot of disparate influences. We'd been a three-piece for years, and there are only so many variations on the guitar drums format. So rightly or wrongly, I was getting into brass sections of female vocals and keyboards and trying to expand our sound. So when you joined the band, you had that audition. Did Paul talk about this idea of expanding things further?
Yeah, he did. He wanted a different sound. He wanted a bigger sound, and it was going more like a Motown sound. That's the way I felt it was going, especially when we did covers like War, Edwin Starr, and then Get On Up and stuff. Definitely, he was going for more of a Motown type sound with the brass section.
And we'll talk about those live gigs, Top of the Pops and things. There's so much more to come on this this story. For a lot of the diehard jam fans, this wasn't the most popular decisions for everybody, was it? Adding brass to that setup.
No, it wasn't. I found that out when we went to the Michael Sobel Center. That was a real intense atmosphere. Very, very intense atmosphere. It's first major show that I actually did with Paul. And we get out on stage and there was like 150,000 skinheads rushing towards you. Quite nerve-wracking, but not for us, I should say, but really for his warm-up act, which was Bananarama.
So that was the Christmas gigs. That was the CMD Christmas gigs, right? Yeah. So that was the first experience live with the jam.
Real experience live.
Yeah, Bananarama were not a popular thing with the... No, were you there at that gig anyway? Yeah. And then the Questions were on that bill as well, I think. Was that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of jazz, funk, soul. I mean, Paul Barry's been on the podcast and they'd obviously just signed to the Respond record label. I think we had Department S as well.
Department S was on. Yeah. Vaughan Toulouse.
Yeah. Is Vic there?
Sorry?
Is Vic there?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
That's a good one.
I'll keep that in. I'm proud of that moment. I mean, yeah. So this is all pre the jam.
Yeah.
Can you remember the sound check? Were people in the sound check?
Oh, wow. Then you know what? The sound checks were just not really that intense because Paul would actually just play about three chords and say, okay, that's enough. No problem. You know, as long as they were out there, the outboard sound, people were okay with everything. He was quite happy.
Were there like production rehearsals and things like that before that then?
There were a few before, yeah.
Okay. So that fit with the full band. I mean, when you look at that set list, I mean, there's banger after banger. I mean, earlier on we had a playback of All Mod Cons here, but you know, the tracks that are part of that set list are just absolute bangers, aren't they? Because this is the jam right at their height, right at their peak, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's entertainment. was probably a main feature on that one. Obviously, Town Called Malice, which I ended up having to play. I played the keyboards on the Trans Global Express tour, which was quite good, and on the Top of the Pops and all the actual other TV shows around the world that we did.
22 songs, and this is before the albums came out. And I always find this fascinating with Paul's stuff, where he's road testing new songs. Even on the last tour, we had a brand, like as a solo tour, we had a brand new song that nobody had ever heard. He's not afraid to put those things out into the world. And that tour, we had like 5 songs that hadn't yet been released.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen.
You're going to have to refresh my memory on those. Well.
But also it finishes with a cracking version of Give Me Just a Little More Time, Chairman of the Board. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was a great song.
And there was like proper full-on brass from you and Keith on that, which was fabulous. So we'll come back to the live stuff in a sec, but let's talk studio. You mentioned Malice and Precious and things like that you played on. So The Gift. So this is the sixth, the final album from The Jam, released March 1982. You go into the studio in October 1981. This is just off Oxford Street. It's Air Studios, right?
Air Studios, yeah.
Which is George Martin's place.
Yeah, George Martin's place. Yeah.
Good vibe. I mean, Paul was always, from the Style Council and solo years, done this residential thing. Obviously, he doesn't own that studio.
First time we actually did use their studios. It's really strange because we're up there playing Paul, and Paul McCartney walked in and immediately Paul dropped his cue stick and went over to Paul, you know, to say hello and everything. And then later on that day, you got a picture and everything. But that was quite strange seeing Paul McCartney. But then again, because it's George Martin's studio, you know, you would expect him to be there.
And obviously we then get this, what would you say, like soul. We're getting the funk, a bit more R&B and the Jam sound, even wah-wah guitar and things. Yeah. It's you're funking it up, man. This is new for the Jam.
Especially when it came across to doing Precious. That was very, very funky. And I didn't even know until the end of the song that Paul's saying, okay, we want to put some solos on at the end of this song. I don't want the solos in between. I want them right at the very end in order to like give it more intensity and more fire. I think more fire, he said, was his word. That's what happened there.
Did you ever feel any pressure to, pressure. Did you feel, like I say, this is the biggest band in Britain at the time. Did you feel like, I've got to be good here?
I was sweating. I definitely was sweating, especially doing that one. I mean, like I said, from the beginning to end, it was quite an intense ride, I would say. There were no 2 days that were exactly the same. Every single day was different.
Now, the release of Town Called Malice and Precious, double A-side, gets to number one, and they're the first group since the Beatles to play 2 songs on Top of the Pops.
We actually only found out when we were doing the Top of the Pops that day that they wanted us to do 2 songs.
So was the idea to do Malice?
It was, well, to do both of them.
Yeah, but initially it was Malice, and then they told you, we want Precious as well.
Yeah, we want Precious as well. Yeah, the actual program directors turned round to us and said, we want both songs.
Because you're not playing live, are you?
No, not playing live at all.
So is there a bit of you that feels like a bit of a Burke? Or, not Frankie Burke, but just a bit of a Burke. But
like, you know what? It's quite a small room. When you're doing Top of the Pops, it's smaller than this room here that you're in. And it's only probably a third of the crowd. It's just the way they actually put the cameras. The way they show you on the camera angles actually makes it look bigger. But obviously, and the sound is terrible. It's actually quite shite.
Are you playing?
I'm just.
Well, you wouldn't know what to do. And particularly if you're like Paul, you're singing.
Well, you can mime your finger actions, in terms of what notes you're playing. Definitely. Sure, Paul would be miming. His guitar wouldn't be plugged in.
Right.
But he'll be playing the chords. So it's like you're warming up, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But are you conscious of the fact that I need to put my fingers in the right places, because otherwise somebody watching on this on TV will be
because somebody outside will look at you and say, he's not playing. He is miming. But you see that with the singers as well. They do exactly the same thing. But then some of the singers that don't are not professional enough, you can tell that they are miming. You have to put in that intensity that you put in on the record up on stage. So you've got to act even more.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Why don't they just get people to play live? More complicated from a production point of view, but they also had to do the whole thing where people would have to re-record the backing track and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, they were doing that at some stage. I think later on they were doing that. They were getting people to re-record their backing tracks. and then singing live over the backing tracks that have been re-recorded.
Which is bonkers. Yeah. Again, that was from like a Equity type.
It's an Equity thing, I think.
Yeah,
it was
mad.
Until Equity, they changed the rules that you didn't need to play live. Now, but you still get paid.
So for those two songs, you're also in the video. So we get, and again, Top of the Pops is the same. So it's Town Called Malice on keys. Right. And Precious on
trumpets.
Okay. Yeah. So talk me through the video making experience. Obviously done both in the same day because they're shot the same.
Yeah. The one for keys, Town Called Malice, that was quite strange because Paul said to me, you know what? I've got this idea. White glove.
I've forgotten about the white glove. Yeah.
Yeah. White glove. Why don't you put a white glove on?
Just one.
Yeah. And one white glove. So I put on this one white glove and that's what you see me playing this one white glove and playing the melody.
Just because.
Just because.
Yeah. I love it. That's fabulous. I mean, Malice is such an incredible, iconic, well-loved song to the point of the European tour recently, he didn't play it for the first time in ages. People were furious.
Wow.
They love that song. I mean, obviously, it's brilliant, isn't it?
But it's on everything.
Yeah. I think it's the keys that bring it to life.
Yeah, that little melody. Yeah. And it's a shame that I didn't write the melody, though.
Oh, so was Paul going, this is it? And
it was, no, it was the engineer, Pete Wilson. Yeah, Pete came up with the idea for the melody. He actually played the melody on the record. I just emulated it for him.
You know? Oh, I see. Cool. So you're not, okay. So you just... Yeah. Because he didn't model a white glove, that's why. No. He refused.
He still gets paid for it, though. Oh,
no. So the album comes out March 1982. And at this point, we don't yet know that it's the final album.
No.
You obviously had no whisper that in the next 6 months, this is all going to come to an end when this album's released, right?
Not really. I mean, there were sort of intense things going on behind the scene.
Oh, tell us more.
No, you could see there were...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A slight divide starting to happen. Like, I can't remember before, it was before Japan, we were on tour in Europe. And you could see that there was slight divide going on between what Rick wanted to do, what Bruce wanted to do, and Paul wanted to do, obviously. No, because I did hear rumors of things saying he wanted to move on, but
right. You know. It gets a bit cliquey, I guess, because I think Bruce and Rick were still really close. Maybe Paul was pulling away.
Well, not really. Bruce used to try and drag me out every night, every single night. Bruce wanted me to be his sidekick. I don't know why.
Like wingman?
Like his wingman, yeah. Yeah, Bruce wanted me to be his wingman, you know.
Oh, the stories we could tell, I'm sure.
Rick was, my wife's over there. In terms of Rick now, Rick was more getting more into photography and he was just everything. He was more intense with his photography, especially like in downtime. He was definitely taking pictures like left, right and center and concentrating on that and talking a lot about Gibraltar. Yeah.
Why?
Because that's one of the places he said he'd love to retire to.
Oh,
yeah.
I did not know this.
Yes.
I'll have to ask him about that.
That's what Rick was always on about.
Gibraltar. What happened? Okay, right. Transglobal Express Tour. How many of you in the room went along to that tour?
Oh, wow.
Whole heap of you, right? So this is quite a long time on the road. I mean, Paul didn't tend to do long stints, but this was like 4 months on the road, wasn't it?
More than that.
Was it?
Yeah. On and off, it ended up about a year I was with them.
Okay.
But probably solid on the road was 4 months.
We have Europe. We have Sweden, Denmark, Holland. And you're traveling around on coach a lot.
Yeah.
How was that? Are you all in the same bus together?
Yeah, we're all in the same bus. Yeah, traveling around the fjords was really beautiful in Norway. You know, first time I'd been that side.
And what were the audiences like? What was the difference between the audience here in the UK versus overseas?
Over here, obviously, more intense. but overseas, yeah, they would be lively. For every single country, you would get some real, real diehard fans. And then you'll get the fans that were quite curious, but loads of fans everywhere.
And what, hanging around, following you where you are?
Hanging around. They were there like a good hour and a half before the shows, usually, and definitely following you around. Yeah, there were people that were going from country to country.
There's some of those people in the room who I know do that still. And very lovely they are too, I have to say. But it's
country to country.
My missus said that. She's like, why would you want to go and see the same person doing the same set every single night for 2 weeks, which is my proposal to her for the European tour? I'm like, it's not the same every night. You don't understand.
Yeah, every show is different.
Yeah, it's a different experience. The venue's different. The crowd's different. Sometimes it properly kicks off, which it would have done in the jam days, right?
Yes, it would. Yeah. Sometimes there'd be fights at the front. Sometimes there'd be fights at the back.
How off-putting could that be if it properly kicks off?
After the first show of seeing that sort of situation, just thought, okay, this is what's going to happen. So you get used to it.
By that stage, presumably the gobbing stops. I mean, this is far off.
No, that still went on.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, are there any of you, the gobbers in the room who are doing, I mean, I just cannot get my head around that.
No. Yeah, that was always there.
You want like riot shields in front of you, don't you? Like, that's disgusting. I mean, at this point, obviously the band, bang on top. Like I said, we've had that double number one, the Top of the Pops and stuff. You joined at the right time. I mean, the hotels are nicer, for instance, aren't they? The bus is sort of transit van. It's pretty lush and all that.
Sleeper.
You joined bang on point, didn't you?
Yeah. It's a sleeper. It's the first time I've actually done a tour like that where you were actually sleeping on the bus and it was comfortable.
And who out of the three of them, who was the worst snorer?
Probably Kenny.
Oh, bless Kenny.
Sorry, Kenny.
I can imagine that would be true. I should ask you then about the card score. I mean, it comes up on pretty much every podcast. Did you gamble? Did you play the cards?
Oh, yes. The card one there. We got stuck one night at Glasgow Airport. We all sat down to play cards. Paul got the cards out and John said, I'm not going to play now. I'm not going to play right now. I might play later. But John ended up playing. Paul ended up playing. Bruce ended up playing. Keith and myself joined in, ended up playing as well. Little did we know that those three, the other three, apart from me and Keith, we actually had this little system going. So they let us win to start with.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I was up about 120 quid. And then the next thing I know, I'm down about 120 quid. So I ended up losing quite a bit that night.
Oh, well, the three of them are like in on this.
Yeah, they're all on this little scam, aren't they? It's sort of, let them win for a bit first and then we'll...
This is new information. I love this. What absolute bastards. So you're thinking I'm earning a few quid. You know, I'm with the... Yeah, this is...
My per diems have gone up quite considerably.
Yeah, so Mick Talbot was here yesterday and he said he did it once and then he got out.
Yeah, I was out after that. No.
Never again. Obviously, this feels like it's a bit of a sign of things to come with the Style Council, in the sense that Paul's adding brass, which becomes such a big part of the Style Council sound, doesn't it? And you working on the arrangements with Keith wasn't just the records, that was obviously the live thing as well.
Yeah, the live thing was slightly different. We just made it a bit more, added a few more notes in here and there, just to give it that slight difference at every show as well. So,
and Rick's talks about like struggling on the stage, like struggling to keep the volume under control almost, because like everybody wanted it turned up a bit more. He wanted it louder. Paul wanted it louder, right?
Yeah, they were loud. They were very, very, very loud. And the reason why they couldn't hear each other on stage was because it was too loud, you know, and then we couldn't hear ourselves playing. We kept on having to say like, we need more in the monitors over here, more over there. But then in the end, we just went with it.
But I love the fact that the solution is just each of them just turn it up a bit louder. It's not to think about balancing. It's like, I want my bit up, I'm going to have my bit. And then suddenly you're just raising it.
No, the level was so high. I mean, after the tour, I came back, I did lose a bit of my hearing. Yeah, even now, up to today, I've still lost a bit of my hearing.
There was a couple of weeks off on that tour, and then you're off to the States. And obviously, we kind of talk about the Jam not necessarily cracking the States in terms of huge chart success, but you go to some big old places like Washington, we're in New York, we're in Boston, then we're in Canada, then we're back to West Coast, US, yeah. We're Michigan, Chicago. I think they're three nights in LA.
LA, yeah.
So, I mean, some big tours.
Yeah, LA was mad. That was mental outside Tower Records. There was a crowd going all the way up Sunset Boulevard, all the way as far as the eye could see for Tower Records that day when we went in to do a sign-in.
Okay.
Absolutely crazy.
And they take all the band, like you're part of the band. It's not just the Jam are the three of them and then there's these other guys. You're part of the mix.
We came in, we went in for all the sign-ins and everything as well. Yeah. I mean, all the fans wanted our signatures as well. I don't know why, because we're not actually part of the band, but we are in terms of instrumental playing in the gigs and shows and stuff and on the records.
But it's quite unusual, I think, that for bands to be that inclusive. Do you know what I mean? It's like, they're protective over the three.
Yeah, they were very, very kind to us, you know, looked after us, no problems.
Let's talk about Japan.
Yep.
You go there next, and this is the final gigs for you as part of the setup.
Yeah.
So we go back to the three of them, I think, after that, presumably. But
yeah.
I mean, that sounds pretty wild. But the gigs, again, the audience is very different.
The audience in Japan was, how can I put it? Very stiff. They were very, very silent, and they were told not to clap, not to jump up until when each song was finished. And then Paul actually, during one of the shows, Paul just leapt out to the audience and said, "For God's effing sake, clap, jump, do something." So he really wanted them to actually have a bit more, you know, a bit more life. You know, I know things have already changed now in Japan. They're going on now 20 years. Things are definitely a lot different.
And was that your first time there?
It was my first time in Japan, yeah.
So culturally, what are you going? Are you still Bruce's wingman at that point? Are you going out?
At that point, no. No, we had great fun in Japan. I mean, especially Tokyo. But the only thing I found about Japan was everything was very, very small in terms of the seats. You know, you sit down, it's like you're sitting in a primary school chair. It was
you can't get out again.
Yeah.
Let me read you some of the songs played on that tour, right? I mean, this is, like I said earlier, this is how incredible, it's like, I mean, this is just ridiculous, right? So In the Crowd, Pretty Green, Ghosts. I mean, what a tune. The Great Depression, Start, Town Called Malice, Precious. We go from Precious into War.
Into War, yeah.
Whose idea, where did that come from?
Paul's.
Yeah?
Yeah. We tried it in London earlier and it worked really, really well in the studio when we were rehearsing at Nomis. We went straight from Precious into War and it worked really well. So they thought we'd keep it in the set.
We get Private Hell, David Watts. Then we get Pity Poor Alfie, which goes into Fever.
Mm.
Again, can you remember how that came about? Was that just
No,
jamming
I
away?
Don't remember how that one came about.
Okay. Funeral Pyre and just Who is the 5 o'clock Hero? I mean, my God, what an absolute incredible banger lineup, right? Now that wraps things up, June 1982. Paul then goes off on holiday to Italy, comes back, has a meeting with Mick Talbot. And like we said yesterday, Mick Talbot woos him and he breaks up the Jam is the story. That's what Mick said if you were in the room. How did you find out then that the Jam were going to be no more? And how did your involvement in the band come to an end?
Well, you know, at the end of Japan, there's a really funny story. At the last show that we did in Tokyo, we had the set list taped to our monitors. So the set list was in English, taped to monitors. The night of the show, it was in Japanese. They actually changed our set list into Japanese, turned them into Japanese.
What, it was like a wind up or?
Yeah, it was complete wind up for us. So, because it's the last gig. And then also, I picked up my trumpet to play my trumpet and all my vowels were turned the wrong way around. And in Keith's saxophone, they'd put talcum powder down his saxophone. So when we went to play, nothing was coming out. Yeah, nothing at all. So it took us about three songs into the show before they could actually hear us.
And initially, I'm guessing you're thinking it's the sound guy, the sound's not coming out. You know, you don't know they're pissed about with it.
No, we knew straight away. I haven't seen the set list and something else was up. But it's around that same time that we thought, because earlier on during the day, Paul was like hinting that he might want a break, you know, so I'm thinking the other two were like huffing and puffing. So there was, you know, on the horizon.
So you could see the kind of, I guess you could see what's, it wasn't a great surprise when they announced the split for you then?
No, not for me, that wasn't, no.
And you can see this kind of tension. We should also mention, obviously, the Trans Global Unity Express I think we were viewing it in the green room earlier on. It came out on VHS and Laserdisc. Did anybody have the Laserdisc of that thing? And this was the Bingley Hall in Birmingham. Where's Shane Jewson? Shane here. So Shane, we can see you in that video, Shane, right? Yes. Five cameramen with their cameras anchored to the pillars to avoid the crush of more than 5,000 fans waiting in the mounting excitement to capture the power of the jam live, is what the video says. Do you ever watch that back?
I've watched it a couple of times, but not over the last X amount of years, but I have watched it back. Yeah.
I mean, can you believe you were part of that setup?
Not until everyone sort of reminds me every day. It's like, yeah, it's quite strange because I'm quite a private and quiet person when it comes down to that. Even when I went off to do my own thing, I still don't like really watching myself back on TV, you know, but I get all these phone calls saying, oh, you was on this, you was on that. I'm going, which one? Oh, the jam. And then I said, oh no, Loose Ends. But it's one of the things that I don't like doing for some reason.
It's also one of those things that must creep up on you. So if you have, you know, they do like the classic Top of the Pop shows.
Yeah.
And you're just settling down with your lovely wife, the kids, you just watching.
Yeah, happened quite a few times.
And then bang, you're on the telly.
Yeah. That's happened quite a few times, actually. I usually get up out of bed or go get up out of the room and go somewhere else.
Because, oh God, he's got the white glove on again.
Yes. Yeah. I look 20 years younger or 30 years younger.
I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? We're talking now about a band that split up, 40 years ago. That time has just passed in the blink of an eye, isn't it?
Yep. Totally. It's like yesterday.
Let's talk Loose Ends. So, post the jam, I mean, the Loose Ends was a thing before the jam as well, right?
You know what? I got a phone call from Mick Clark, who's no longer with us now, saying that they wanted to sign me while I was on the jam tour. Yeah, for a publishing deal. Because I already submitted demo tapes to them. And cut a long story short, I said, no, I'll wait until when I get back off tour. Then I'll come in and do the necessary paperwork. So that's how that happened.
And this is Branson's record label?
Yeah, Richard Branson's label.
So Virgin?
Virgin, yeah.
Wow, I mean, bloody hell. To come off the jam, we're straight into Virgin Records.
Yeah, no mucking about there.
And we should say Loose Ends are the first UK-British soul band to go over and break the US, which deserves a round of applause on its own, I think. What an achievement.
Thank you.
Just unbelievable. I mean, you're having chart success at the same time as the Style Council, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you ever on the same bill?
No, I think we did. I don't think we did Top of the Pops once, but they were on like a week before us. But it's definitely the same time, same period.
Yeah. Same vibe, yeah. And Paul's even more into that kind of soul, funk, the R&B stuff.
Yeah, because he had DC Lee up front, fronting it. So, yeah, and I knew DC Lee as well before that. Yeah.
And Loose Ends become the first ever British number one on the US R&B Billboard chart, which knocks Prince off number one.
Yeah, we knocked Prince off number one.
What was the Prince song?
Was it I Would Die For You, I think?
Oh, okay. So it's Purple Rain time, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, it was a big one.
He rings you up.
Yeah, he rings us up in the limousine.
We're
in the limo and driving around New York. And then we got this phone call from Prince. And he said, oh, well done for knocking me off number one. Quite strange.
I mean, there's somebody you want to be somebody's wingman for, Prince. That would have been interesting, right?
He did take me out for dinner.
Did he say, come on party? Was that the thing?
Yeah, he said to me, come out. Yeah, he said to all of us, come next time in LA, come on party with us.
And you did that? Or you went out for dinner with
him? I went out for dinner with Prince, yeah. That's crazy.
Talking about a story. I mean, can you imagine partying with Prince? Oh my God.
I can't even go there.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's the book, right? The Steve Nicol book. Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if this is true because you never know with Discogs, but you have a writing credit on Michael Jackson's final studio album.
Yeah.
Unbreakable. The opening track.
It's actually some of the music. They sampled some of my music. Yeah.
So how did you find out about that?
The publishers have this thing whereby they try and collect all your royalties from around the world. And anyone that sampled anything, they will call you up and say, oh, by the way, you have got a percentage of this or that. So it could be Michael Jackson. It could be anyone else. But just this one, particular one, happened to be Michael Jackson.
I foolishly didn't ask you to bring the trumpet with you. What was it, trumpet or keys?
No, it was keys.
Keys. And what was the bit?
I'm not even sure. I'm really not sure. All I know is I've got this lovely credit from Michael Jackson. So,
I mean, that looks good on the CV, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's good on the CV. Brilliant on the CV.
Hey, look, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much. I mean, there's so many stories that you've got from your career that, I mean, there needs to be a book. Why is that? Yeah. I mean, you mentioned you're a very private person, but
yeah.
This has got to be a thing, right?
There are some really, really good things. There's really some funny things that I can remember. But the funniest thing is watching Bruce Foxton trying to play tennis. That is funny. I see you laughing.
From what point of view?
We were in Palo Alto and I don't know how it came about, but there was this tennis tournament going on for all the residents in the hotel block. And we decided to enter. And so as me and Keith were like one at a team, and I don't know who Bruce teamed up with, but watching him try to play tennis, no coordination. He might be a brilliant bass player, but, you know, no coordination whatsoever.
That's unfortunate, isn't it? Because he's always had the hair for it, hasn't he?
The
be on board kind of.
That was quite funny. And then trying to watch him dance as well, really.
Tell me. Where was this? Well, this is out.
This is out.
What places did you go to? Was it like disco? Was it you were trying to find like a bit of fun?
A little bit of fun at clubs, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah. And do people know when you... Oh, this is brilliant. When you're out, do they know that it's you and Bruce that are out?
We used to have one of the bouncers used to come with us as well. So, yeah, that used to be fun. Used to be fun.
So they knew, they could tell you were showbiz.
Yeah, they knew. Well, they knew we were, really.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be put over to a little corner and then we're just saying, oh, I think I want to see a bit of the action. I want to go for a dance. So, you know.
Your wife's in the room, so we can't go any further, but this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you. Hey, look, right. So you are allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What are you going to go with?
What would I go with? That's Entertainment.
Ah, why that one?
Because I like it.
Did you notice? I noticed the pitch of your voice changed there, like mine does when I'm very excited.
That's Entertainment. It was a toss up between That's Entertainment or 5 o'clock Hero.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Which you played on?
I played on 5 o'clock Hero.
Okay. So final question. As you'll know, the purpose of this podcast, the purpose of this whole event, folks, is for me to get the interview with Paul Weller. It's the only reason I said yes to the weekend, I'll be honest.
All right.
As much as I love Stuart and Nikki, it's for me to get the interview with Paul Weller. We're now, 150 plus episodes in.
Right.
Back in the day, Gary Crowley could just go to a red phone box, pick up the phone, ring Weller's family home and get an interview. Now you have to do 150 episodes of a podcast.
Right,
for
before you actually get any interest.
Yeah. If it ever happens, what should I ask him? What would you like to know?
What would he like to know? Where does he get his shoes from? Because he's always, every time I've seen Paul out, he's always got these lovely shoes on.
They're nice. I've never seen him in a pair of Nikes, have you?
No. His shoes. Where does he get his shoes from? Yeah, they're really nice.
That's a great question. Did he ever, I should have asked, did he ever go out to the clubs with you?
He's always tucked up in bed.
Oh, yeah, because Jill was obviously around then. So, yeah,
Jill was still around. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, look, this has been such an absolute delight. Please do give it up for Steve Nichol.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, there you go. My thanks once again to Steve Nichol. What an amazing guest on the podcast, and so lovely to record that one live in front of an audience at the big Weller Weekender. Thanks again to Nikki Weller and Stuart Deebill for inviting me along. More on that to come in the future, I hope. Don't forget, you can check out the show notes to this podcast. Just head to my website. It's paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're there, head into my store. You can get your official podcast merchandise and you can get a virtual coffee if you fancy it. Hello to Sean Wilson, who's done exactly that. Hello, Sean. Thank you to you for your generosity. Hi to Phil Baker. Hello, Phil. Much appreciated to you for your subscription. Nice one. Hello, Alex McLaughlin, who says the Mick Talbot Honorary Counselors was great fun. Mick Talbot is always a brilliant and funny listen. Enjoyed the chat from Kamel, Jay and Stuart too. Thank you, Alex. Cheers for your virtual coffee. Hello to Georgia Moroso. Hello, Georgia. Hello to Grants. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee, sir. Hello, Duncan. Thanks for your support. Thank you to all of you for getting involved. Much appreciated. If you want to head to my website, you can. PaulWellerFanPodcast.com. You can also get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod or on Instagram, Facebook and Threads. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. On the next episode, another multi-award-winning guest joins us. Make sure you follow, you subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts. Spread the word on social media as well. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.